Well, good evening or good morning, wherever, whenever you're listening to this, to Gallatin Valley and the online listeners. You are listening to KGBM, Bozeman Community Radio, broadcasting at 95.9 FM and streaming at kgbm.org. It's time again for Desert Oracle Radio Replay. I'm Roxana, and I wonder if you've noticed the shifts this week. With one more week of August to go, birds are not as chirpy, and I imagine the new bunch has mostly fledged. Gallatin County is having red flag warnings. Things are drying out, but temperatures are a bit cooler. And have you noticed the return of certain bobcats to the MSU campus? Wild times over there. It all has me in an introspective and, frankly, a bit off-kilter state, so bear with me. Our show today begins with a Desert Oracle Radio episode created by Ken Lane, April 17th, 2020. A lot of the things he was pondering then are worth pondering now as we advance towards fall, accompanied by measles, flu, and COVID. I've just restocked my COVID and flu tests. Here is Return of the Wild Things.
Transmitting from the Mojave Wilderness in Joshua Tree, California, now is the time for Desert Oracle Radio, the voice of the desert.
Night has fallen on the desert in springtime, God's gift to the patient. If cactus blooms and carpets of wildflowers are the love of your life, patience is a virtue. The springtime stretches into July in some parts of the desert. Places like the Eastern Sierra, the Slick Rock Country, anywhere the winters are cold and occasionally snowy, the higher elevations. Spring is well underway in Tucson, and Anza Borrego well underway or nearly gone, it depends. Depends on the rainfall, depends on the last year or next year, depends on the increasingly weird variations caused by catastrophic climate change. Up here in my little corner of the desert, it is peak spring, and honestly, it's the first spring I've truly enjoyed up here in many years. Yes, it's been an exceptionally cool and wet early spring with more snow than I've seen up here in a decade, and a very steady delivery of storms that managed to make it over the mountains and bring some rainfall to this arid land. There's so much rainfall that I almost got used to it. Putting on this rain gear that's starting to crumble from age and lack of regular use. Lacing up the Marine Corps water-resistant rain boots. Toweling off the dog and convincing him to sit by the fire for a while afterwards, when he'd really rather go jump in my bed and provide it with that nice, mildewy, wet smell of old wet dog for the next week. And everything's blooming pretty good, but what's so sublime about it this year is the lack of people. For the first time since Joshua Tree National Park became a popular destination in about 2015, and up till last year with its astounding and terrifying 3 million annual visitors, This part of the world feels like what it's supposed to be. Protected wilderness. Sparsely populated and seldom visited public lands. The boonies. The middle of nowhere. The other day, pulling invasive mustard weeds around the house, I watched a pair of ravens giving absolute hell to a pair of nesting red-tail hawks who live up in the big pine tree here. Itself a non-native. Planted, I guess, about a half century ago when the house I occupy was built. It sort of sticks out, but this is its home amongst the Joshua trees. Like myself, I'm not from here. Nobody's really from here. Until the Marine Corps base started to spread out during the war against Vietnam, getting the kids ready for the meat grinder over there, the whole high desert barely managed a few thousand inhabitants. Spread over an area 100 miles across, 50 miles north to south. The population has risen at least tenfold since then, pushing 60,000 permanent residents now. Nearly all of them arrived in this century, the 21st. Just in the last 15 or 20 years. Well, now that the visitors and the tourists and the weekenders are gone, it's just the people who were blown by the winds and wound up here. Some by choice, mostly by circumstance. A lot of visitors don't quite comprehend that this is a low-income rural area. More than 20% of the residents live in official poverty. The real number is greater. Only half the adults work, half don't. Even with California's better-than-nothing health care for the poor, 10% of us don't have any health care at all. Nearly 40% are renters, which has been a real rough game since the Airbnbs ate up the rental homes and turned them into $200-a-night vacation destinations. Until now. We have as many food banks as places with double the population. That's in part because people are so spread out here, especially as you go north into Landers and along the Marine Base boundary east into 29 and Wonder Valley. But the food banks are staffed by elderly volunteers mostly. And it has not been safe for them to be working in crowds. So half of our food banks are closed when the need is largest. And all the locations were routinely low on food anyway before this happened, before the outbreak. When our school district shut down a month ago now, the local Board of Education decided to keep the cafeterias open. So that people could pick up a day's worth of food for their kids each morning, if there was anyone available to drive a car to the school in the morning. You see, because otherwise half the kids would go hungry. We went to all no-cost lunch in our district a year or so back, because even in our fend-for-yourself desert of people who mostly just want to be left alone, it was understood that making half the kids go hungry for lack of a couple of dollars to pay the lunch lady was an unnecessarily cruel system. And that's just here, my neighborhood. My little part of the world. It's about the same in every rural area around a desert national park across the Southwest. It's a lot worse on the reservations. So it's just the residents out here for now. The residents and a really belligerent contingent of people who still show up here with their REI camping stoves and their late model SUVs and latest models of sleeping bags and dome tents, who come here anyway because they figure they'll just camp on somebody's property or on Mojave Desert Land Trust wildlife preserves, or in our understaffed and officially closed county natural areas. And boy, do these jackasses bray when they're told they can't set up their holiday camp here. Sure, use the ground as a toilet, start up a wildfire with your firewood, and infect some 70-year-olds working at the Walmart when you go get more beer. Why not? Who cares? Who cares that the entire high desert has 4 intensive care beds and a little local hospital already struggling under the weight of an elderly and impoverished population? 1 in 10 with disabilities. Who cares? Now, I've had a couple of people get up in my grill lately because, God forbid, I've posted a couple of pictures of wildflowers, mostly in my backyard. First, I hope everybody's going outside and smelling the wildflowers. They're all over. This is a time of year when the California poppy springs up in every kind of untended bit of dirt. Whether it's between the boarded-up high-rises of Oakland or the boarded-up Caltrans-owned vacant houses of Los Angeles. Think of that, vacant housing everywhere. And people living in parking lots. In Las Vegas, which has no tourists right now, they've got the homeless in parking spaces in the empty parking lots. Wouldn't want to let your fellow human beings use an empty hotel room and get some isolation from everybody else during a pandemic. Now, I know this will shock a lot of people who love Instagram because there aren't too many words to hassle with, but Joshua Tree National Park is a sliver of the Mojave. Now, while the Mojave is known as the smallest of the American deserts, this small little desert reaches from Los Angeles County to Death Valley, to the Colorado River, to and through Las Vegas and up to Area 51 and over into the southwestern corner of Utah and the northwestern corner of Arizona. Is big. Is little, but it's big. You'll never see a fraction of it. Now, most people who live around my local national park rarely, if ever, visit it. Unless a relative's coming to town and you need to drive them through, wait in the traffic lines, etc. Same is true of most national parks. Some people just don't care one way or another. They just moved out of Long Beach after the Rodney King riots and kept driving until they could afford a homestead. These are the people with the Confederate flags flying over their 2 acres of wrecked cars and outdoor sofas, protected with 8-foot fences topped with razor wire. But a lot of people out here, most of them, love the desert. They love the quiet and the landscape and the extremes of heat and cold, the road runners and the quail, sleeping on the porch in the summer to the song of the coyotes. And it turns out pretty much anything in the park is also outside the park. Boulders and yuccas, hedgehog cactus, swollen with the rains. Those strange tumor-like growths on top soon to transform into huge, beautiful flowers of bright red petals. The planets and the Milky Way in the night sky. The mourning doves ineptly building their nests in the eaves. People walk with or without their dogs each day. Often just up and down the sandy dirt roads, waving to neighbors, picking up some trash, being good citizens. Sometimes up some casual trail under the boulders, they know when it's a good time to poke around the rocks and the brush before the rattlesnakes come out, and when it's a good time to stick to the open landscapes in the summer. They know how to tease a kitchen garden out of this harsh region, mostly by ignoring all the full sun advice on your food crops, because this sun will fry pretty much anything unless it has a lot of every day in the shade. And they've likely not been to Pappy and Harriet's in many years, if ever. They don't attempt to get a drink at the saloon unless it's about mid-August and 200 degrees out with the parking lot empty. And a lot of people I know these past few years have packed up and left because it got crowded here. Lucky to occasionally attract the interest of a newspaper reporter looking for an excuse to spend a work day in the desert. And most of them have asked me what I like about Joshua Tree. What I liked about the high desert, the high des. Yucca Valley, 29 Palms. About favorite hikes in the national park, etc. And I've mostly said, politely of course, because I've worked for newspapers myself and I generally enjoy the company of people in my trade, now and then. That I really don't like any of it. I live here because circumstance required me to live in something approaching civilization. It's not my ideal, living around so many people. But kids need to go to school, or they used to anyway. My own little business, half-assed as it has always been, has benefited from the tourist trade. I can't lie about that. But the day approaches. Not too long now. As soon as the last of my 17 children, all by different mothers, are out of high school and off on their various life adventures, when I will say goodbye to this too crowded place that's too close to too many people, and retreat to my long-planned retreat. Far away from here, but very much a desert place. Get thee to a desert place. Of course, I will continue doing whatever it is I do, a radio show, typing, maybe even publishing more issues of the Desert Oracle, if we can manage to keep our postal service for another few years. And if not, who knows, maybe I'll deliver them myself. Once a year or so. Like that Kevin Costner. Maybe by then we can socialize again. I do love to see people in moderation every year or so. I'll bring the whiskey, and we can sit on the porch and visit a while. And then maybe take a walk with your various dogs before I have to hit the road again, get to the next delivery, just a couple of hours away. Now, there are characters out there on the social media especially who do get irate when you mention how nice it is in the wilderness without all the people. How pleasant it is to have a blue sky not full of car exhaust, to not have miles-long traffic jams to the ticket booth, to see wildlife returning to the wild places we've turned into motorized tourism centers. Now, some of these people are soft in the head, it's true. And others are just dummies despite their well-off parents' best efforts at good breeding. But nonsense does have a way of taking over the discourse, as they say, maybe on the morning edition or whatever. Some things considered, both sides now. The skies are not blue again because people have suffered and died from the virus. The skies are blue again because human beings, even the most terrible human beings imaginable, have endorsed and enforced the public health plan to limit the rapid spread of the virus. And despite the thousand missteps, both intentional and accidental, the virus has been somewhat controlled. The reason bears and herds of mule deer are returning to Yosemite Valley in great numbers is because of society's decision to react to an emergency. It is an example of how we can take a short-term hit for the long-term health of society. And it is precisely the kind of good example we need to follow going into the necessarily rapid and worldwide end of fossil fuels and a full transition to a human civilization that uses clean, renewable energy and renewably powered transportation. And you know, if it takes fear of a worldwide pandemic to make people think twice about casually using the filthiest form of transportation, that's a passenger aircraft, well, so be it. Now, there are lots of good efforts already underway in Germany and California and other such nation states, otherwise bogged down by the company they keep at the moment. And unlike shutting down for the virus, a rapid transition to clean energy and clean transportation is going to create hundreds of millions of jobs. Good-paying, meaningful, fun jobs around the world. Jobs that are going to have pensions and unions and good benefits and public oversight and plenty of time off to enjoy life. To enjoy the better world we are creating right now. And if any of my professional environmentalist friends start saying, well, there's no truly clean energy and etc., I am going to climb out of this radio and whack you one. And you'll deserve it. There is no perfection in human endeavor. Outside of maybe Georgia O'Keeffe and Richard Wagner and Billie Holiday. Everything else is left to the rest of us knuckle-dragging dum-dums trying to do the best we can in the face of collapse and greed and uncertainty. No way is certain. If it was, there'd be no need to bother. Let somebody else do it. The way is certain. Now, one thing we're going to do, coming to a revolution near you and requiring you, is we're going to need to get the traffic jams out of the national parks. Regardless if they're Honda hybrids or Tesla luxury pickups, it's time to open up the national parks to people. And shut the damn gates forever on the private vehicles, which have no place in our most sacred places. The newspaper articles don't mention that part of Yosemite always has bears and deer and bighorn and mountain lions and clean air and peace and quiet this time of year. It's the High Sierra. The part that doesn't usually open up to vehicles until late spring or early summer. The valley is open all winter long, a thick, thick stew of smog stuck under the inversion layer. Motorhomes and Mercedes belching out their diesel exhaust. Winding mountain roads packed with people headed in for the holidays. Well, guess what? You can still have holidays in Yosemite Valley. Just leave your vehicle outside. I mean, Edward Abbey laid it all out more than 50 years ago in his book Desert Solitaire. Consider what could be done with Yosemite Valley. At present, a dusty, milling confusion of motor vehicles and ponderous camping machinery, it could be returned to relative beauty and order by the simple expedient of requiring all visitors at the park entrance to lock up their automobiles and continue their tour on the seats of good, workable bicycles, supplied free of charge by the United States government. Let our people travel light and free. Their bedrolls, backpacks, tents, food, and cooking kits will be trucked in for them, free of charge, to the campground of their choice. Why not? The roads will still be there. Once in the valley, they will find the concessionaires waiting, ready to supply whatever needs might have been overlooked, or to furnish rooms and meals for those who don't want to camp out. The same thing could be done at Grand Canyon or Yellowstone or any of our other shrines to the outdoors. There is no compelling reason, for example, why tourists need to drive their automobiles to the very brink of the Grand Canyon's south rim. They could walk that last mile. Better yet, the Park Service should build an enormous parking lot about 10 miles south of Grand Canyon Village, as at Yosemite, where our people could emerge from their steaming shells of steel and glass and climb upon horses or bicycles for the final leg of the journey. Pull down your copy of Desert Solitaire. I keep mine with the King James Version and the Shakespeare and all the other references you need to keep close at hand. From Amboy to Zizek's and across the great Mojave Wilderness, this has been Desert Oracle Radio. I'm your host, Ken Lane. We broadcast from Joshua Tree on Friday nights, locally, on our home station, family-owned and operated KCDZ 107.7 FM. Take care. Good night from the voice of the desert.
It's the bottom of the hour, and you are listening to Desert Oracle Radio Replay, broadcasting on KGBM, Bozeman Community Radio at 95.9 FM and streaming at kgbm.org. Well, this is the time of the show that I always like to read a little bit about nature. So, from Nature, One Day at a Time by Kathy Katz, for August 24th, she writes, "The praying mantis, Mantis religiosa, is a symbol of the power of stillness and patience. According to many Native Americans, whenever Mantis got himself into trouble, he would go off to be alone. He would then go to sleep and wait for the solution to his problem to come to him. With remarkable stillness, instead of hunting, the praying mantis waits for food to come to him. At the exact right moment, after not moving for a long time, the mantis reaches out a long spiny foreleg to grasp an insect who walked or flew by just a little too close. Anyone who has swatted flies knows the speed needed to hit them, let alone clutch one sandwich style the way the praying mantis can. A female may eat the head of her sex partner, probably to increase her level of protein, calories, and nutrients so she'll produce healthy offspring." And then she closes with a quote from John Alcock in A Desert Garden. And he writes, "Mantises have been around for millions of years, and it may take us a few decades more before we can finally resolve the challenge posed by the occasional occurrence of cannibalism by mating females. While we work on this mystery, may the survivors sow what they can on our behalf in the garden, waiting patiently in a prayerful mode for a pest to come their way." And for August 25th, she writes, "Flies react to rapid motion but can't detect slow-moving objects. When a praying mantis or lizard catches a fly, it's usually after a long and extremely slow approach. The brains of flies, although sophisticated in other behaviors, simply don't process slow movements. Their own approach to food is an automatic response to a depleted sugar level, which triggers a solution. Fly around until food is detected. Their familiar zigzag flight is their way of hunting, and when food is sensed, the fly lands near it. The fly then walks until it locates a meal, usually carbohydrates. It sucks the food with its proboscis. If it isn't sweet enough, oral receptors shut down, and the fly receives a signal to look elsewhere for a better solution. When the fly finds a good meal, it continues to feed until nerve fibers send a signal to stop. In laboratory experiments, when those nerve fibers were cut, the fly would eat nonstop and literally blow itself up from eating more food than would fit in its body." And she closes with a quote from Sarah Van Breathnach in Simple Abundance. And Sarah writes, "If it's not delicious, don't eat it." And then from Daily Observations, Thoreau on the Days of the Year, edited by Steve Grant, August 24 of 1852, Thoreau wrote, "The year is but a succession of days, and I see that I could assign some office to each day, which, summed up, would be the history of the year. Everything is done in season, and there is no time to spare. The bird gets its brood hatched in season and is off. I looked into the nest where I saw a vireo feeding its young a few days ago, but it is empty. It is fledged and flown." And then on August 25th, 1852, he wrote, Does a mind in sympathy with nature need a hygrometer? I'm not sure if I said that word right. I'll probably have to look it up. Okay, should have done that before, but I didn't. Well, Henry David Thoreau also wrote a statement about crickets. It was August 21st, 1852, when he wrote, "The sound of the crickets gradually prevails more and more. I hear the year falling asleep." And you're probably saying, what does that have to do with anything? Well, I'm bringing this up because I have just fallen in love with the sounds of the crickets at night when I go outside around 10 to view the sky. And with this last week's black moon on the 23rd, the stars have been amazing too. And several nights ago, we even saw northern lights. I hope you got to see them too. But those crickets, oh my gosh, it's more of a trill that I hear. And I've been doing a little investigation into the cricket world. It turns out they very likely are tree crickets who hang out on trees, of course, but also on tall native plants and shrubs. The ones I hear every night seem to be in my wild raspberry patch. Here's a little bit from the Montana Field Guide about them. And Field Guide says, generally, tree crickets are characterized by their long, slender shape, pale colors, and arboreal habits. The four wings of males are broad and flat, and the female wings are long and narrow and wrapped closely to the body. Their legs are very slender, armed with two rows of minute teeth interspersed with a number of delicate spines. The feet are three segmented, with the second segment being small and compressed. The antennae are longer than the body, thread-like, and often ornamented with distinct black markings. The first two basal antennal segments are distinctively marked with spots, which are a convenient diagnostic character for species identification. And this is a very slender-bodied tree cricket that is basically uniformly pale green. Some individuals may have a pale orange wash on the top of the head and or a few black spots on the hind femur. The wings are translucent with a pale green wash. The antennae are usually a light grayish. Song is produced only by males, which raise their forewings perpendicular to the body and vibrate them in a transverse direction so that the overlapping inner portions rub against each other. The sound-producing mechanism is located near the base of the wings. It is a broad, expanded distal area which serves as a resonator to increase sound volume. A short, prominent transverse vein occurs beneath, forming a rasp-like structure about 1 to 1.5 millimeter wide, with 20 to 50 or more short teeth, depending upon the species, inclined toward the opposite wing. The number of teeth is a diagnostic feature. The right wing, termed the file, bears a series of downward projecting teeth, overlaps the left, termed the scraper, and when the wings are raised and alternately opened and closed, the song is produced only on the closing stroke. Due to this partial wing motion cycle, cricket songs are constructed of sound pulses. If a cricket opens and closes its wings many times in succession, it produces a trill. If the wings are opened and closed a few times, pauses, and repeats the song again, it produces a chirp. Songs vary according to ambient temperatures and is distinctive by sound analysis between species. The four-spotted tree cricket sings day and night and tends to be more diurnal than other species of acanthus. Its song has been described as a rich, high, somewhat raspy, continuous trill. In late afternoon, where populations are numerous, individuals will synchronize their singing into an almost deafening chorus, which often lasts through the night. So I'm wondering if that's what we have here. Well, how about a little more from Montana Public Radio, Bug Bites?
Hi, I'm Jen.
And I'm Glenn.
And you're listening to Bug Bites.
This show is made possible with support from the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communications on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans.
In nature, insects come in all shapes, sizes, and colors. Even within the same species, body size and other characteristics can vary considerably from one individual to the next.
For male insects, when it comes down to passing your genes on to the next generation, it's generally the bigger, stronger males that have the most success in attracting the females. But for those lacking in stature, you can often make up for it in surprising ways.
Take the tree cricket. Known for their rather loud mating calls, smaller and therefore quieter tree crickets are at a disadvantage when broadcasting their love songs. But what these smaller crickets lack for in size is more than compensated by their ingenuity, something that proved baffling to scientists, literally.
Not the confusing kind of baffling, we're talking about the amplification of sound. While tree cricket baffling was initially described in the 1970s, it was not until more recent studies explained the details behind the mystery of what was going on.
Lacking the ability of their larger counterparts to loudly profess their desire to mate, small tree crickets were observed chewing holes in the center of a leaf and sticking their head and forelegs through the opening.
With their noise-making wings now positioned at the center of the do-it-yourself megaphone, the diminutive tree crickets were able to double or triple the volume of their calls. The bigger the leaf used, the louder the results, and the more alluring their calls were to the ladies.
So while conventional wisdom has always told us that in nature, it's the biggest and the strongest that earn the right to mate, we now understand that it's really the biggest, the strongest, or the most inventive.
Bug Bites is made possible by the Missoula Butterfly House and Insectarium and produced in association with Montana Public Radio.
And earlier today, I talked about one kind of bobcat making its return to the Bozeman campus. But what do we know about our four-legged species? Well, here's a field note to help inform us.
It's time for Field Notes, brought to you by the Montana Natural History Center. This winter, I was out walking along the snowy creekside trail up the Rattlesnake Recreation Area north of Missoula when I chanced upon a young friend of mine, Andrea Stevens. Andrea is a naturalist and educator for Swan Valley Connections, just north of Seeley Lake. She was sitting in the snow on a short, steep hillside, looking off into the near trees. "Are you seeing something?" I asked. She pointed ahead of her to a bobcat lounging on the branch of a Douglas fir, about 20 feet up, just about eye level with our view from the hill, and only about 30 feet away from us. With soft gray fur speckled with random brown spots, she was well camouflaged despite her also speckled paler belly fur. From our close vantage point, it had still taken me a minute or so to see her, even with Andrea pointing her out behind a few overhanging small branches. The bobcat sat still for quite a while, but eventually, to our great excitement, we saw a medium-sized kitten poke its head out from behind her, their marvelous and seemingly calm faces turned right towards us. A kitten? In the depths of winter? Bobcats usually breed mid-February through mid-April in Montana, with kittens born 50 to 60 days later. However, they can breed all year, and sometimes do. Perhaps this kitten was a late-season birth. Sleuthing about before I arrived, Andrea had discovered a cached adult deer at the base of the tree, all covered with grass and snow. Could the bobcat, who normally preys on rabbits, hares, birds, and small mammals, possibly have killed the deer? They are only about twice the size of a house cat and weigh no more than 35 pounds. Killing a deer would be quite a feat. Andrea had noted that the deer's legs were somewhat disjointed, but the bones were not cracked to reach the nourishing marrow. Since bobcat jaws are not strong enough to break the deer's bone, there was one point in support of the bobcat killing the deer. I asked local experts if little bobcats ever kill deer. Yes, was the answer, but not often, and it would be a tough battle. Further, the bobcat would not linger around if it had been a mountain lion's deer. So there was another point in possible support. There are many deer in our neighborhood, and lots of cars go whizzing along Rattlesnake Drive, so another strong possibility is that the deer might have been hit and wounded, thus making the bobcat kill more feasible. Still, I'm impressed, and I'm told this is an incredibly rare event. I explored along the trail again the next morning. The bobcats were gone, and the deer was mostly devoured. The stomach, uneaten, was lying on the snow adjacent to the carcass, but the magpies and crows were raucously enjoying picking the bones of the feast. I am continually amazed and in total wonderment at the wildlife we have here in Montana, even in our own backyards. Bobcats are relatively common in patchy habitats all across the U.S., but we don't see them often because they're crepuscular or nocturnal and well camouflaged. But after this experience, I will be poking around for those small 2-inch roundish tracks and looking up about 20 feet much more often than I used to, hoping to see another bobcat someday lounging on a branch. I'm Ellen Knight for Field Notes, brought to you by the Montana Natural History Center, providing natural history education for schools and the public throughout Montana. For information on upcoming events and programs at the center, call 327-0405 or visit our website at www.montananaturalist.org.
Talk to you about some events. I'm going to give you an early heads up so you can make your plans. The Gallatin Clay Tour is coming up. It's posted as a weekend celebrating ceramic arts in the Gallatin Valley. On Saturday, September 6th and Sunday, September 7th, from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m., you can celebrate regional ceramic artists in their studios and in galleries across the Gallatin Valley in conjunction with TinWorks 2025 exhibition, Akin to Clay, and the annual Montana Clay Meet, hosted this year by Bozeman Community Kiln. Work will be available for purchase directly from local artists in their studios and from participating galleries. The 2025 Gallatin Clay Tour also offers participants a rare opportunity to see Francis Senska's Clay Studio in Bozeman, hosted by Shelburne Murray. Participating artists include MSU Ceramics Guild members and faculty, participants in TinWorks Open Call for Ceramic Work, and the late David Drake, Marguerite Wildenhain, and Francis Senska. You can find the large list of the rest of the contributing artists with work in the Gallatin Clay Tour, along with details on studio locations and open hours at the TinWorks website. And that's www.tinworksart.org/events/Gallatin-Clay-Tour. Physical maps are also available free of charge at each of the locations participating in the tour. And we have some film screenings this week. The Librarians will be at the Rialto On Wednesday, August 27th at 7:30 p.m., Ten Works presents the award-winning documentary, The Librarians, which follows the story of librarians who unite to combat book banning, defending intellectual freedom on democracy's front lines amid unprecedented censorship. The film will be followed by a post-screening conversation with director and producer Kim A. Snyder, executive producer Allison Benson, and Montana Library Association's Kirk Vriesman, moderated by Montana State Senator Cora Newman. This event is at the Rialto Doors and Cash Bar at 6:30 p.m. Screening begins at 7:30 p.m. Tickets are $10 and space is limited, and reserving your spot is recommended. Also, there's a free movie night, and it's called Porcelain War, and it's rated R, and it's Thursday, August 28th, 2025, from 8 to 10 p.m. in the Asterisms Room, free to all, and here's a little description. Under roaring fighter jets, Ukrainian artists Slava, Anya, and Audrey chose to stay behind. Defiantly finding beauty amid destruction, they show that although it's easy to make people afraid, it's hard to destroy their passion for living. And by the way, that first movie, The Librarians, that's going to be at the Rialto. And the second one I told you about, the free movie night, The Porcelain War, that's going to be at Tin Works. And also, it's almost time for the Fall Gallatin Watershed Cleanup, and they need your help. On Saturday, September 6th, from 2 to 4 p.m., you can volunteer to remove trash from Gallatin Gateway to Manhattan, and then join up at the cleanup after party at Bogart Park at 5 p.m. There will be plenty of food, drinks, and prizes from our amazing event sponsors to celebrate your hard work. So you can sign up to lead or join a team and read more about this event on their website, which is www.gallatinwatershedcouncil.org/watershedcleanup, and that's all one word at the end, watershed cleanup. Well, you probably heard our resident trains down at the crossing a couple miles from where I live, and I think you're about to hear the cars all coming up the road that were piled up behind those trains. It's a thing here. Okay, just so everybody's safe, right? All right, well, I want to thank Ken Lane and Red, Blue, Black, Silver for sharing their work on Desert Oracle Radio. Thanks to all the volunteers and supporters of KGVM. Thank you, Montana Public Radio and Bug Bites and Montana Natural History Center for our field note today. The cricket sounds were from my raspberry plants, and the bobcat sounds came from Acoustic Atlas. Thanks to Steve Grant and Kathy Katz for our nature readings from their books, and thank you for listening. If you have a story you'd like to share, you can leave a voicemail or text for me at 406-404-6246. This program broadcasts on the air at 95.9 FM Bozeman Community Radio, or you can stream it online at kgbm.org at 7 Sunday nights and 9 Monday mornings. Our past Desert Oracle Radio replay episodes are also available on demand on the kgbm.org website. I'll be back next week with more desert and mountain lore for you. Till then, watch the skies, keep doing good things, stay well, and sweet dreams. See you next week.